United States doesn't give a damn about what the rest of the world is thinking here. This is about what Washington plans to do.
The oldest technique of propaganda is just simply lying. That's what's usually called black propaganda.
Each time they drop bomb, men will fly into the air and drop. These people that are dying and all these body parts that are flying, they're somebody's children.
Well, that's really ridiculous. The idea that Iraq somehow has to prove it. If they don't have any weapons, how are they supposed to prove that they don't have any?
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, December 20th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush said today that Iraq's weapons declaration showed Saddam Hussein was not serious about disarmament and marked a, quote, disappointing day for those who long for peace. We expected him to show that he would disarm, and it's a long way from there, said President Bush. What's included or excluded from the documents submitted to the UN by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein depends, it seems, on who's reading it. Secretary of State Colin Powell issued a formal response yesterday from the Bush administration, and today we sought a more progressive interpretation of the 12,000-page report. Peace Watch spoke with Jim Paul, Executive Director for the Global Policy Forum. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the Iraqi report totally fails to meet the UN Security Council's requirements and constitutes, quote, another material breach. But during a question and answer period with reporters yesterday, Powell says too much has been made of that term, material breach. He explains that it's a legal term that essentially means a party has failed to meet a commitment. And he went on to say,
I think we're using the term to make it clear to the world that once again we have a breach on the part of Iraq with respect to its obligations, and therefore the spots have not changed. The important point, I think, is that from what we heard from Dr. Blix and Dr. Albaradei this morning and what I heard from other members of the council who have spoken is that there is no question that Iraq continues its pattern of non-cooperation, its pattern of deception, its pattern of dissembling, its pattern of lying. And if that is going to be the way they continue through the weeks ahead, then we're not going to find a peaceful solution to this problem.
Your response to that?
Well, the United States clearly is trying to, through multiple assertions, to persuade the world that Iraq is in breach of this resolution and does have these weapons. But there's really only one way to find that out, and that is to actually have the inspectors go ahead. Hans Blix, he says, is putting forward a position that's similar to the U.S. This is absolutely not true. Blix is in favor of continuing with inspections and letting the inspections determine exactly what the Iraqis have.
Mm. And yet a Russian official was quoted as saying the U.S. alone cannot determine what constitutes a material breach. What does the resolution outline in terms of a process, how the process should be adhered to?
Well, the inspectors are supposed to come in with a report in January, which will allow the council to make an initial assessment of the situation. But at any time, the inspectors can come back to the council if there's some major obstruction by Iraq or otherwise they've discovered something important. It's only the council that can make a determination as to whether or not the council's resolution has some way been broken. But it's also only the council that can decide what ought to be done about it. And these are the things that the council members said again and again when they made their statements after the passing of Resolution 1441. It's not a matter for the United States to decide whether there's been a breach, and it's not a matter for the United States to decide what should be done.
Mm. Well, does it appear that the support for Iraq is sort of evaporating among those main council members? Even the French ambassador, Jean-David Levite, said, and they tend to support Iraq, or at least be a defender of Iraq, quote, the declaration does not clearly answer and resolve pending questions.
Well, I think there's a difference between whether it answers or resolves questions and whether or not it represents somehow proof of Iraqi duplicity and so on. there's no question whatsoever that this large number of documents that's been presented by the Iraqis to the UN doesn't in and of itself prove anything. It doesn't prove that they have no weapons, and it doesn't prove that they have them. It's a basis on which there will be an inspection process. And some people who've examined it closely think that there are certain discrepancies between what was known before and what's in this report. Whether that's a serious and whether or not that proves somehow that there's weapons there, I mean, you know, no, it doesn't prove anything. It just has to be inspected.
Powell says the burden remains on Iraq to prove its innocence. In other words, Iraq is to be considered guilty until proven innocent. That's backwards, isn't it? I thought our entire jurisprudence rests on the principle that one is innocent until proven guilty. How can we conveniently switch that concept to suit our immediate purposes? Let's go to what his actual words were.
The burden remains on Iraq. Not on the United Nations, not on the United States. The burden remains on Iraq to cooperate fully and for Iraq to prove to the international community whether it does or does not have weapons of mass destruction. We are convinced they do until they prove to us otherwise.
Jim Paul?
Well, that's really ridiculous. I mean, the idea that Iraq somehow has to prove it. If they don't have any weapons, how are they supposed to prove that they don't have any? It is up to the United Nations inspection process, and it's up to any country such as the United States of America that believes it has evidence that they have weapons somewhere to come forward with that evidence and say, this is it. The United States doesn't want to do that because they don't have sufficient evidence to prove it on prove that the Iraqis actually do possess these things. They want to go to war. They want to get Iraq's oil. So they're ready to make assertions and to turn the normal judicial arrangements on its head.
Mm. The Secretary of State Colin Powell also says that the world is not willing to wait forever.
Resolution 1441 calls for serious consequences for Iraq if it does not comply with the terms of the resolution. Iraq's noncompliance and defiance of the international community has brought it closer to the day when it will have to face these consequences. The world is still waiting for Iraq to comply with its obligations. The world will not wait forever. Security Council Resolution 1441 will be carried out in full. Iraq can no longer be allowed to threaten its people and its region with weapons of mass destruction.
Your reaction to that, Mr. Paul?
Well, all this talk about the world, of course, the United States doesn't give a damn about what the rest of the world is thinking here. This is about what Washington plans to do. And they intend to go ahead with this war, and that's what basically the Secretary was saying.
Also, he's quoted later as saying that a final determination and decision on whether to disarm Saddam Hussein by launching a military attack against the people of Iraq will not be made for several weeks. But of course, several weeks could fit neatly into the Pentagon's plans for a February attack. How do you read that?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, it's been very clear since September, if not before, that the United States was planning to carry out a military attack on Iraq in the window of opportunity in January and February when the desert temperatures were low. They've said that publicly on a number of occasions, and the timetable has all been revolving around that. So their determination that there was some kind of a breach had to be done without a reference to any inspections or any reality on the ground. They have to just assert it and go ahead, and that's what they're doing.
Is war still inevitable at this point, do you think?
I think war is very, very likely. I wish it weren't. It's pretty outrageous, but there we are.
Jim Paul, Executive Director of the Global Policy Forum. Secretary of State Colin Powell's remarks yesterday seemed to firm up the Bush administration's drive towards war with Iraq. And despite Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz's prediction earlier this week that this would be an easy war, many observers remain unconvinced. Among them is James Fallows, director of the New America Foundation and author of The 51st State, An article in the November issue of the Atlantic Monthly about the administration's long-term plans for Iraq. Fallows says that what lies ahead is no simple task, and he now feels pessimistic about the prospects for peace.
I think the odds for an actual war have gone up a lot in the last 24 hours, and I think it's not simply... It would have been different if, say, Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld or Paul Wolfowitz had been making this announcement. What we have simultaneously Colin Powell, who internally has been arguing a diplomatic route, plus, say, the French and the Russians not really making contrary claims. I think that that means the administration strategy over the last 2 months of going to the UN to get consensus seems to be coming together.
Didn't we, however, hear the Russians say that the United States alone could not determine whether a material breach had occurred?
Yes, that is so, and I think there certainly is more diplomatic effort ahead. I think what's been one of the most interesting aspects of this last several months is why and when the administration decided that it would try to go internationally, it would try to deal with the United Nations, and what sort of negotiations have led to this, what is, in relative terms, a surprising degree of consensus. Very few people would have bet 6 months ago that the U.S. could have gotten the 15-0 vote or the acquiescence of the French in particular. So I think that either the statement from the Iraqis was such that some people who might want to support them in the Security Council felt they couldn't, or the U.S. has been unusually skillful in lining up its allies.
So it's your opinion that the stakes have gone up tremendously in the last 24 hours?
Yes. I think it's significant that that the administration is sort of continuing its move of the last month or so of trying to line up international alliance so far with continuing success.
Mm. And at the same time, however, it's been for months now lining up its troops. The Pentagon's been moving some 50,000 troops under the radar, theoretically, so that it's not to appear as though they're prejudging the UN inspection process, while at the same time getting their troops amassed in some 10 countries throughout the Middle East, including Kuwait, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Oman, and Bahrain.
Well, certainly if you look at the actual movement of men, women, ships, ammunition, transport planes, fuel, armaments, etc., certainly it's all consistent with launching an attack relatively soon. And I think the administration, its rationale would be, number one, if it says, all along it said that an attack was one of the options, and so they wanted to get the things in place for doing that, if that becomes the option. I guess number two is their sort of persuasive aspect on allies in particular seems to have been enhanced by this apparent certainty of the U.S. going, whether with allies or not. And I think the administration's argument is, well, if potentially allied countries think this is going to happen one way or another, they will eventually sort of bend with the prevailing wind.
Mm. All this buildup of the troops sort of in the background is so the U.S. can launch a surprise attack, quote unquote, using ground forces, executing a speedy victory sometime in late January or early February. You've been following this and researching and interviewing individuals. What's your prediction? Is this doable?
Well, I think there are various dimensions of doability depending on, on how broadly you want to think of it. My impression from having interviewed military people from a lot of different countries, including some Arab countries, is that as a sort of straightforward military matter, nobody now doubts that the U.S. could win relatively quickly. It would probably be bloodier for the U.S. and for Iraq than any engagement the U.S. has had since the Vietnam War.
What does that mean, bloodier? I don't want to get too gruesome here, but I guess we are talking about war.
Sure, we're talking about war. And there's two different dimensions of the blood. Essentially, there's the U.S. side and the Iraqi side. Because so many people were out on a limb with predictions of casualties from the Gulf War, almost nobody will give you a kind of projected body count now. But it certainly would be, most people think it would be at least several hundred, perhaps 1,000 American casualties, and perhaps some multiples of that, and many multiples of that, obviously, of Iraqi casualties, because a ground war blows things up, an air war, inevitably destroy some things. And so there will be, you know, some thousands of people on both sides combined who will die.
And they are talking about a ground war in this instance.
Well, it's one stage or another, ground troops have to go in there, because as precise as some modern weapons, modern bombs can be in the ideal circumstances, they still can't catch people. They can't occupy territory. And I think one of the lessons of Afghanistan was that the bombs did a sort of an important initial job, but then without having ground troops there to sort of capture the al-Qaeda leadership, et cetera, a lot of the effort can be lost. And so ground troops have to go in there at some point by definition to occupy the country.
Mm-hmm. And hypothetically speaking, if Saddam Hussein is removed from power, what then?
That's one of the enormous questions for everybody. And I think that the administration has wanted to discourage that question because, you know, by definition, it raises questions about the war. If you start thinking, well, gee, maybe there's going to be complications. I think there's sort of several levels of perhaps not crisis, but real immediate challenge that would happen after the war. One is simply on the humanitarian grounds of a lot of people will be dead, wounded, homeless, hungry, without shelter, without water. The U.S., would be responsible for taking care of them. There's the business of figuring out who would run an occupied or Saddam-less Iraq, where a number of Iraqi exile groups have been saying, let's have none of this U.S. occupation business. You know, we are Iraqis, so let's have us run our country. There's also this sort of the surprisingly important territorial integrity issue. The Kurdish groups in the northwest of Iraq and a number of the groups in the southeast bordering Iran, both are not sort of automatically attached to the center of Iraq that the U.S. would be occupying. And so somebody would need to sort of have military troops to defend against Iran in the southeast, to hold down the Kurds in the northwest. And so that also is going to be a real challenge after a hypothetical war.
It's been reported that General Tommy Franks is going to be sent in to, I guess, become the de facto ruler for a while.
I think that would be an initial, almost by default, kind of judgment. You know, he's been the commander of the troops with responsibility for that part of the world. But it's interesting how uneasy almost everybody would be with that outcome. You know, the Iraqi exile groups, that they would like to have their own people. The U.S. military is surprisingly uneasy itself with these civilian occupation roles. You know, 50 years ago, Douglas MacArthur was kind of the governor of Japan in a quasi-civilian, quasi-imperial role. The U.S. military does not want to do that these days. They find it a kind of complicating and compromising situation. So I think everybody will be trying to look for what would come after Tommy Franks, and the answer is not obvious.
Some experts and observers of the situation have said that it's if the Iraqi exiles believe that they are actually going to be put into positions of power, that they're basically deluding themselves.
That seems to be the consensus, except for the Iraqi exiles themselves, where they've many of the groups, although not all, have led kind of a high life in Europe and the U.S. Over the last decade, and they're not seen as having really deep roots among the people in Iraq now. So, the problem here is there's sort of no answer to the question of who is the natural next leader of Iraq after some kind of war, after some kind of coup, because domestic resistance obviously has been eliminated. The exile groups are not really legitimate. The U.S. can't really run it for a long time, and there's somebody has to answer the question, but there's no obvious answer to it now.
Well, you pose a question in an article that you wrote, the 51st state.
Yeah, I was saying that if the U.S. decides to go ahead with warfare, it needs to be aware of sort of the long-term consequences, which the more unilateral the war was, the more the U.S. would be responsible in quite the long run for taking care, for better and worse, of Iraq, of reconstruction, of policing the place, et cetera, of making peace with its neighbors. And so I think it's quite an open-ended obligation we'd be taking on.
And what would you envision as the worst-case scenario there?
The worst-case scenario is that it was something that would happen on basically the first day of the war, and it many military people spell it out this way, that on his way down, Saddam Hussein, who has not used his weapons of mass destruction for the last 10 years, decides, what has he got to lose? And so he starts attacking everybody. He attacks U.S. troops with chemical weapons, and he launches everything he has at Israel. And Israel at that point decides, well, this is their time to eliminate some potential enemies too. So Ariel Sharon attacks not just Iraq, but Iran, Saudi Arabia, et cetera. And there then you have Armageddon in the Middle East. So that is the worst-case scenario. The U.S. has been working very, very hard to try to sort of contain Israel's lash-out possibilities and also to see if it could get rid of some of Saddam's weapons before they're used. The idea is to avoid a complete U.S. versus the Arab world, end-of-days type showdown there.
James Fallows, director of the New America Foundation, and author of The 51st State. Anti-war activists are hoping that expressing what actually happens once the bombs are dropped will prove to be a deterrent to this war. Dr. Blessings Heaven is a local poet and singer who lives in the nation's capital. She wrote the song "Soldier is the Son of a Woman" after watching a British comedy entitled The Longest War. The Nigerian songwriter dropped by Pacifica Station WPFW earlier today to add her voice to the anti-war chorus. She spoke with Peace Watch producer Reem Kadhuta.
I was watching this movie, The Longest War, and as I was watching it, I saw that each time they drop bomb, men will fly into the air and drop. I started thinking, these people that are dying and all these body parts that are flying left and right actually belong to somebody. They are somebody's children, some woman's son. And that was when I started thinking that this song in my head, that soldier is actually a son of a woman. He's not just nobody. He's recruited to go to war, but he's just not a nameless nobody. A woman carried this son for 9 months, nurtured him, and now he's blown up in a second. We all call him soldier. We remove the feeling that he's a human being and his body is not meant for this atomic bomb and all these war weapons. And I started thinking, I said, well, if this head of states and all these world leaders will actually talk their problems, they could save the lives of this young man. His body is made to live here, and when it's his time, he dies. So if people will handle their problems peacefully, there'll be no war.
They're building up for a war against Iraq. They've been bombing it for 15 years. How does this make you feel?
It doesn't matter where the war is fought, whether it's fought in Iraq or fought in the street of anywhere or fought at home. War is wrong. It's very sad to see that somebody will die. Like that song says, opinion may vary. You may even be right and the whole world wrong. But as you start working on it, you can work something out. You can prevent war. It's not right to kill anybody for any reason. It's not right. Peaceful solution is best.
What do you think is the role of artists and musicians when it comes to such international discussions and war?
Artists have a lot to do with social correction, let me use it like that, because music inspires. You take everything that you sell, the commercial, everything that is sold on television, there must be music to make it appeal to people. The artists have a lot to do. If they raise their voices against an issue to help the world, to focus on this problem that is on the air, I believe that somebody will listen and somebody will hear. The politicians will think, because politicians are in their office by people's vote. And if people won't vote for them because they think they are wrong, they will rethink their situation or their position. There will be no war. Please don't kill my baby. Please don't kill my baby. Please. Please don't kill my baby. Please don't kill my baby. Please. We can work something out. We can work something out. You may be or you could be black. That's all right. We can work something out. Opinions may vary. Contemplations change. Deliberations may fail. But that's all right. We can work something out. You can even be right, very right, very right. You could be right and the whole world wrong. Oh yeah, but that's still all right. We can work something out. Don't go to war. Don't go to war. When you go to war, somebody could be killed, and that could be my baby. I love my baby. Soldier's the son of a woman. Oh no, please don't kill my baby. Soldier's the son of a woman. Please don't kill my baby. I love my baby. Work something out. We can work something out. We can work something out. We can work something out. United Nations. United Nations. We do appreciate you. We do appreciate all the works that you have done. You've been wonderful. You have tried to keep peace. All the involvement you've had with the whole world is appreciated. Yes. Please, don't be wearied. Don't be wearied. Don't give up. Don't give up. We need you now more than ever. Don't give up. Yes. Stay with the world and party. Stay with them. Arbitrate. Talk both sides. Yes. Until we work out peace. Until we work something out. Even best. Please, go persuade them. Just talk to them. Go persuade them. It's important. Keep speaking until you are heard. Go from place to place and persuade them. Yes, until we work something out. Please don't kill my baby. Soldier's the son of a woman. Please don't kill my baby. North America. Soldier's the son of a woman. Think about it. Just think about it. Think about it the next time you shoot your gun. Think that soldier is the son of a woman.
Dr. Blessings Heaven from her original writing, Soldier is the Son of a Woman. Dr. Blessings will be performing more from her repertoire tomorrow evening at the White House. Thanks to Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer from WPFW, Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., for that segment. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Verna Avery Brown.